This morning, I want to answer the question, why Calvary Christian School? For 45 years, this starts our 46th, we've had a Christian school. Why? Why Calvary Christian School? What's its purpose? Why would our church develop this asset over time? What is its enduring value? Is it still relevant? And there may be some of you thinking in your spirit right now, wow, I don't have a child at the Christian school. Why should I have any interest in this message? Why should I care about the Christian school? Well, you should care because the reasons why we have the Christian school are to as well sit on our conscience if in fact we are a follower of Jesus Christ. Because what we are trying to accomplish at the school, in fact, mirrors what every follower of Jesus Christ should aspire to in developing the mind of Christ and thinking God's thoughts after Him. The reasons why we have the Christian school are the same reasons why we all need to shape our thinking to live well for Christ in our day. So I want to go two different directions, and the first is quite familiar to you. It's just a reminder of what you already know, but it builds a foundation for me to introduce the four words that explain why Calvary Christian School exists. So that's our plan of attack. And I invite you to come to Romans chapter 12 and verses 1 and 2. Now, this is a familiar passage. If you ever, growing up, went to church camp, you could say, I've heard this before. This is like the go-to staple for speakers at camps. I want to read the first two verses and think of it with you. This is a reminder, first, of what you know, then four words that explain why Calvary Christian School exists. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Hear the word of the Lord. These two verses are a call to us. Present your life as an offering to God. It's an invitation, but it's more than an invitation. It's a command. It actually asks us the startling question, what are you doing with your life? What am I doing with my life? What are you doing with your life? Present your life as an offering to God. This is the familiar. This is the, we know this part, Eric. And remember, Jesus said, you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. Let me build a foundation for the four words that explain our school by considering three thoughts from Romans 12, 1 and 2. Thought number one, live life as an act of worship to God. Live life as an act of worship to God. Now, the first phrase that really arrests your attention in chapter 12 and verse 1 is this phrase, the mercies of God. The reader, in reading that, I appeal to you, okay, you're making an appeal to us, Paul. Therefore, brothers, and people in the family of God, I'm appealing to you, and I'm making my appeal on the basis of something, on the basis of the mercies of God. I appeal to you on the basis of the mercies of God. What are the mercies of God? What is he alluding to? Remember mercy. Mercy is what we get from God that keeps us from what we deserve. One of the most glorious things about the God of the Bible is he is merciful. We get from him what we do not deserve in his grace And he keeps us from what we do deserve in his mercy. And so Paul is making an appeal to us. And the appeal to live life as an act of worship to God is based upon his mercy. Consider the mercy of God. Consider the fact that with Adam, we too have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. In thought, in word, or in deed, all of us have broken the law of God. And God, who is holy and just, rightly sees us, therefore, as condemned before him. But the glory of the good news about Jesus is he does not leave us there, but sent his son Jesus, who invites us to receive him, to begin to rely upon him as our hope for eternal salvation, to find in him forgiveness, to find in him and through his death, burial, and resurrection, not only forgiveness, but hope. God mercifully has shared Jesus with us. And in Jesus, we, in embracing him through repentance and faith, find the mercy of God, which keeps us from what we do deserve. Because you and I, because we have sinned, deserve hell. But he, because of his mercy, through Jesus Christ, offers us forgiveness, offers us pardon, offers us hope. God is merciful. That's the best news we've ever heard. It keeps us from what we deserve should we embrace Jesus Christ by faith. And then he is gracious. He extends to us what we do not deserve. But here, this appeal, Eric, why would anyone want to live life as an act of worship to God because of the mercies of God? Well, mercies of God, why does he just drop that concept into Romans chapter 12? That's because Romans 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, the first eight chapters are a description of the mercy of God. He takes 9, 10, and 11 and he talks about Israel and God's dealing with Abraham's children and comes back to put a bow on the package, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, with this introduction, I appeal to you on the basis of the mercies of God. The mercies of God that I've talked to you about in Romans chapter 1 through Romans chapter 8. And the call is simple. The call is for a living sacrifice. Now, all the sacrifices were characterized by actually death. They killed the animal, threw it on the altar, and the sacrifice was characterized by death. But here, the Apostle Paul talks about a living sacrifice. And Swindoll is so apt to, in thinking of this imagery, say that the trouble with a living sacrifice is it has a tendency to desire to crawl off of the altar. To crawl up there and stay there is the challenge of endurance and perseverance in the Christian life. It is also the one metric that tells who the authentic are. For 20 years, as I pastored in one place, I prayed on Tuesday mornings with a group of men, one of whom always prayed, and maybe he got it from Paul, 2 Timothy 4:6, when Paul describes his life, I'm poured out like a drink offering. But he would pray, often he would end his prayer, Lord, help me today and this week to be a poured out drink offering for you. Of the offerings prescribed by the law of God, one of them was called a drink offering. And oil would be put in a flask, it would be taken in, and literally poured out on the altar. So what was in the bottle was emptied, and this was an act of sacrifice because oil was valuable to use. It had oddly even medicinal uses. It was rubbed on wounds. It was used in cooking. It was used for, but it was also used in worship as making a statement to God. So the drink offering was poured out. And Paul uses that imagery. He says, whatever God put in my flask, as I live, I want to pour it out for him. And don't you want to die with a bottle empty? And that's the picture. So he says, by the mercies of God, present your bodies a living sacrifice. Now, Plato and the Greeks had said, all the physical part of us, the body, that's evil, but the spirit, the soul, that's good, and you have this. Well, Paul has none of that picture of two things. Paul, the apostle, always viewed our humanity constituted by God as a soul-bodied unity, as one. By the way, everything you do this coming week with me, you'll do in the body that God has given. Wherever we go, we'll go with this body. So what he is saying is, as we live, where we go, who we are, where we offer that in our body as we live as a sacrifice unto the Lord. This body stuff is about life in the business of the everyday routine, the mundane, the normal, the simple tasks that make up our life. They become an arena in which we can offer the Lord our life. So the charge, the command is live life as an act of worship to God. By the way, if you think about the mundane and the routine of the last week, were you driven by a sense that you were presenting to God with your body the tasks that made up your life in honor to Him? The most holy thing a person can do is to be faithful in the mundane and the routine and offer it as unto the Lord. Now, the second thought is here, fight the pressure to deviate from Christ's way. All right, if the charge is have your whole life become a living sacrifice, but that comes with a challenge. When you purpose to do that, the world is constantly going to be putting pressure on you to become like it, all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, the boastful pride of life. The world system is always seeking to seduce us, to draw us in, to shape our lives around the contour of what is valued. But to get to live life as an act of worship to God, we have to resist the temptation to adopt the strategy, when in Rome, live like the Romans. That phrase actually comes from a letter written in the 5th century. And the answer was, the guy was saying, hey, I'm going to Rome. Give me some coaching. How ought I live when I get there? And one sentence from the return letter is, it is advisable to follow conventions of the area in which you are residing. In other words, when in Rome, do as the Romans. Now, what the Apostle Paul is saying here, as we present our body to the Lord in this moment-by-moment act of worship in the privilege of living for Jesus Christ, one of the things not to do is live like the Romans. No, he's saying live like Jesus Christ, which will make you distinctive, and whatever you do, don't be conformed to this world. It's a bad strategy for the follower of Jesus to live like the Romans. Don't conform. That's the command. The faithful Christian is actually a non-conformist, a counter-cultural person. Remember Paul when he said, time of my departure is at hand, I have fought a good fight. You say, what in the world was he talking about? The battle to resist the call to conformity to the ways of this world is war. It is a battle. It is a fight. Well, to John Wright, the British follower of Jesus, psychiatrist who wrote the InterVarsity book on the Christian life called simply The Fight. For to him, the battle not to be conformed to the world, the battle to be transformed by the renewing of your mind so you could present to God a life in the everyday and the mundane, that was a big fight. And every faithful Christian understands why he entitled that book so. So the question for us, and this is the review part, you know this, how are we handling the pressure to succumb to this world system. Now, the third idea here is we win the battle through renewing our minds. Present your bodies a living sacrifice. Don't be conformed to the world. Give us something good. Don't just tell us what not to do. What are we to do? But be transformed. How in the world are we supposed to be transformed? Through the renewing of your mind. And here, the Apostle Paul argues that living a faithful life engages the mind, and that the mind matters. We win the battle through renewing our minds. This is the way we are transformed, through mind renewal. We push back against conformity by disciplining ourselves in the area of what we think. Renew. Our minds are renewed. That means to make anew, to repair, to renew. Have you ever understood that our minds need repaired? Adam, our forefather, led us headlong into this sinful life, autonomous from God, that we thought was going to turn out for us really well. And that has cast a long shadow, including in the way that we think. The entrance of sin has affected our mind. So we need to be renewed. Remember, Matthew 22, 37. Love the Lord with all your heart. Oh, yeah, love the Lord with all my heart. Oh, love the Lord with all your soul. Oh, yes, love the Lord with all your soul. Love the Lord with all your mind. How are we doing loving the Lord with all of our minds? By the way, growing up, my mother repeatedly asked me this question. Did your mom ever ask you this? Why didn't you use your head? Now, it was usually sorting out some quasi-scandal that I was involved in, some decision I made, some acting out that I was involved in. But Mom would extrapolate backwards and say, why didn't you use your head? Because my mom was convinced what Solomon was convinced of when he wrote that proverb. I think it's the King James Version translation of Proverbs 23:7. As a man thinks in his heart, so is he. So is she. Thinking matters. Why didn't you use your head? Mom was saying, why didn't you think about what you were doing before you did the doing? And how did that doing turn out for you? Look at this mess we're in. Now, thank God for grace. Where sin did abound, grace does much more abound. But that's the right question. Life is fought in the trenches. It's actually urban warfare, but not in the streets, in our minds. And those who live with a renewed mind, tuned to the truth revealed by God, are in the best shape to present a godly, holy life. Well, Eric, that's fine. I've heard that before. Church camp, junior high year. Why on earth does Calvary have Calvary Christian School? Well, because God has called us to love the Lord with our minds. And we've been on a 46-year mission to raise generations who do that very thing. So that brings me to this. Four words that explain why we have Calvary Christian School. Sin affected all of our broken world and every part of our humanity, including our mind and how we think. All of Adam's children suffer from a malady that we must face. These four words describe the dilemma. This is not only for students at Calvary Christian School. This is not only for faculty members at Calvary Christian School. This is for every one of us here this morning at Calvary Baptist Church. We're in the soup together. We need this. And these four words explain just how desperately we need this effort. Word number one, ignorant. Our minds are unaware of the ways of Christ. Here's Peter who writes, "Do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance." Peter, not unlike my mother, arguing that it is the preoccupations of the mind, or should we say it is what our minds are not preoccupied with, that lead to these behaviors. Ignorant, mistaken conduct, sinful conduct, which grows out of a lack of knowledge. 1 Peter 1:13, and we're going to use our Bibles this morning to pick out these four words. 1 Peter 1:13 and 14 say, "Therefore, preparing your minds for action and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance." Now, you have to ask, there's different kinds of ignorance. What kind is Peter referring to here? At its root, this concept means unacquainted with. If you're seeing two kids, grade school kids, sinfully trying to insult each other on the playground, maybe you hear one of them say, "You're ignorant." Designed as an insult, reflecting upon their intelligence. That's not so much what this term is and what this concept is. It's not that kind of ignorance. It means you are unaware with, you are unaware of, and not acquainted with. It's something that can be realized after the fact. I realized something this week, and I'm ashamed of myself. For 60 years, I've used a phrase wrongly. But this week, I just realized it. And I've been, you know, you do it for 60 years, it's hard to break. In referring to something I was focusing on, I would say, wrongly, "I'm going to," here it is, "hone in on this." H-O-N-E. It's wrong. The correct way is home, H-O-M-E, home in on this. I was unaware of that, unacquainted with the proper enunciation. Andy looked up something once, my wife. She studied French in high school, and we've laughed about this since, but every once in a while, and you know, speaking, if you're a freak in nature, is just, I mean, the stuff you think about and the stupid stuff you say, and you know, you put a cover over your head on Sunday nights and you try to sleep and hope that nobody remembered what you said. But anyway, there's a French phrase, voila, kind of V-W-A, English, voila. Well, I was given from time to time, who knows why, to say voila. So Andy looked up voila in the dictionary. And it almost literally says, "Stupid people use this phrase who don't understand French," you know. Well, ignorant people say voila. No, it's voila. And that's probably not even enunciated correctly. I remember I served for 20 years at a church that was right across the street from a motorcycle shop. And one day I was out there in the driveway looking across the street. And the motorcycle shop, Competition Accessories, is up there on the hill and has a little incline that goes down on a two-lane road. And I saw a guy, man, he had a new bike, and he was so fired up, and I was just, look, I couldn't hear anything that was said. And if I was a salesperson, I probably would at least said what I'm sure that guy says, "Hey, dude, you ever been on one of these before? I mean, can you really do this? Oh, man, I got this. This is nothing. I know." And the guy was fully unacquainted with what he immediately became acquainted with after he got on that bike, because I watched him. You know, he fired it up, and he cranked it, round, round. I thought, oh, man, here it goes. I'm going to watch this. He comes down that grade, hops on the road, goes over the road, down into the ditch, and that's the last time I saw him. He flopped that bike right in the ditch. Well, he didn't get 70 yards before he had that thing over. Now, what happened in that 70 yards is he was introduced to what he was unacquainted with before that point. He was living blissfully in his ignorance. It's that kind of ignorance. But then he became acquainted with what he didn't realize forcibly as he tried to get that bike off of him in the ditch because he had flopped it in the ditch right across from there. I wish I could have been a little mouse as all his friends were standing in that circle watching this whole thing go down. I'm sure every time they get together, they remind him of how that looked. The summer of 1980, I went to Australia to play basketball for 7 weeks. And while I was there, you know, they say different words. In fact, there were three sweet ladies from Australia here last week, and I was trying to remember all the kind of unique colloquialisms, and all I could get out was fair dinkum, you know, and that was it. I called one of them a Sheila. Yeah, that was it. And I was trying to remember that wasn't an insult, and I hope it wasn't. But anyway, but when I was there, I noticed they used a phrase to sort of accent things, to stress things. They'd drop in the word bloody every once in a while. That's a bloody good jump shot there, or man, has a bloody good game, you know. And I thought, well, that okay. And so I heard that about, you know, 4 weeks, and I thought, well, hey, when in Rome, you know, I ought to do this, you know. So I start dropping that in, and a guy pulled me aside and he said, hey, look. And he happened to be a godly man who was following Jesus. He said, I think I need to make you aware of something that you aren't aware of. I said, what? He said, that term is used as profane speech here in the land down under. I go, it is? He goes, yeah. And I've watched you, and I've heard you talk to these guys. This will help you if you would not include that in your vocabulary. You know what? I was just ignorant. Ephesians 4:18 says this, we're alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance in them. Oh, you say, Eric, bloody's not too bad. Well, my sister entertained an exchange student from Brazil. Neat guy. We loved him for a long time while he was there and wanted him to have the best experience in America and also wanted to introduce him to Jesus and what it meant to know Jesus in a real and personal way. And he's a neat guy. Along the way, he told my sister quietly once that when he turned 16 years old, his father took him to a prostitute as a way of coming of age. His dad just thought, you know, this is how to do it. This is right. And his dad was unacquainted with where indulgence takes you. His dad was unacquainted with the ways of God and the glories of how God has called us to live. He just thought that was right. He was ignorant of the ways of God, unacquainted with the holiness of God. 2 Corinthians 10:5 says we are to destroy arguments. That's about facing ignorance. That's about Christian education. The renewal of the mind brings us to become aware of the life that we are called to. You say, Eric, what's going on at Calvary Christian School? Well, with 2 years of preschool and kindergarten, we are involved in a 15-year ignorance abatement program right up on top of the hill. Pouring the truth of God into these lives, doing away with ignorance, and urging them to adopt the mind of Christ. Second word is the word futile. The word futile. Our minds are preoccupied with the inconsequential. You know, according to the Bible, it's appointed unto man once to die, and then after that, the judgment. We will all stand before God and give an account for what we have done with our lives. And the thing that I do not want God to ask me in that moment is to ask me, Eric, will you just answer one question? What were you thinking? What were you thinking? Or to have the Lord ask me, how comes you wasted your life? That haunts me a little bit in the fear of God, holy kind of way. Futile. Our minds are preoccupied with the inconsequential. This phrase out of Romans 1:21, they became futile in their thinking. They became futile in their thinking. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world. in the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts are darkened, which anticipates where we're going next. Futile. It's a passive idea. It's to be given over to worthlessness, to begin to think idle things and worthless things. The noun form of this verb, it shows up in Romans 8:20. All of creation has been subject to, there's the notion, futility. Ephesians 4:17, the godless people called Gentiles by Abraham, the pagans, they have a mind set. It's called a futility of mind. 2 Peter 2:18, they speak loud boast of folly. Now, by the way, everybody needs hobbies. Everybody needs diversion. Everybody needs joyful things that they love to pour themselves into. But could our collective experience of not very much joy as a culture in America be related at all to the futile things that we are giving our lives to? I was trying to share Christ with a guy I was golfing with one day. And he told me he loved football. And I was talking to him about the glories of knowing Jesus Christ and to have our sins forgiven, of coming into a relationship with the living God through Jesus Christ by his death on the cross that removes our sin, bringing us to the hope of the resurrection, a hope we live with and a hope we die with. He said, well, my church is NFL football. I said, what? My church is NFL football. And he was extremely devoted to his church. I mean, all day long on Saturday. And now, what is it? Thursday night, Monday night, Saturday during the playoffs, NFL Network, 24/7, 365, you can get it all. His church, what he was describing was a unique devotion to NFL football. Now, if you like football, that's great. There's nothing wrong with liking football. There's everything wrong with having unique devotions to things that are worthless. Are you devoted right now to things that will last 1 minute after you die and be around? Or are we pouring ourselves into what doesn't matter at all? It's time to inventory our thoughts. We want to be preoccupied with what matters, that will last beyond our last breath. What's your thing? What do you think of a lot? What do I think of a lot? That's what we love. It's possible to be captured by empty, worthless idol. Calvary Christian School is an invitation to ponder the truth and ponder eternity and to embrace it. Well, thirdly, darkened. Ignorant, futile, darkened. Our minds are clouded from seeing right living. I used that phrase out of Ephesians 4:18 a moment ago. Minds, they are darkened in their understanding. Everybody's trying to understand why mass shootings happen. I don't presume to have it figured out, other than man's heart is deceitfully wicked. Who can know it? The Dayton mass shooter, I am told, was a part of a vile rock band whose name, I hope this doesn't offend you, I'm trying to illustrate the dark places our mind can go. Porno grind rock band. The album cover that they made included a lady. The insinuation in the picture, without clothes, ravaged, without a head, dismembered. All tragic mass shooting stuff isn't as much gun as it is mind. And our mind can go to very dark places. You take men given to binge pornography, corrupting their mind, that leads to images of abuse in debauchery, beatings. The mind keeps getting darker and darker and darker. So dark that it's nothing to take up an assault rifle and make sport out of killing people. In Genesis 6:5, it says before the flood that every intention of the thoughts of man's heart was only evil continually. Wow, every only evil continually. Do we recognize where our dark minds can take us? It's why we have the school. Because here's what's said of Jesus. In him was life, and the life was the light of man. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. You know, one problem with the dark is you can't see what's going on. We need our minds reshaped. It was Jesus who said, I am the light of the world. Finally, it's the word hostile, ignorant, futile, dark, and hostile. Our minds are antagonistic to the ways of Christ. Think of Colossians 1:21. You who were once alienated and hostile in mind. The mind can be an enemy of godly living. From Adam, we have this embedded bias against God, even a hostility. Our minds are enemy combatants to righteousness till mercy and grace turn them around in a 180 that brings us to renewal, to think God's thoughts after him. Our minds needs that renewal. That's why we have Calvary Christian School. That's why we have Calvary University here at church. That's why we have adult Bible fellowships here. That's why we have life groups that are discussing the implications of what we're talking about on Sunday morning in the message. My dad bought his first house. We moved in. It's 1964. I was a little boy. And the kitchen floor decided to reseed into the recesses of the footings under which the guy had added onto the house. Trying to figure out what in the world's going on. Well, I'll tell you what was going on. Termites were having a delightful time eating the kitchen superstructure that was holding up the floor. So that little lean, we uncovered a horrible issue of corruption. So the first thing, step one, treat the whole house. Get rid of the problem. Take those sinful termites out of the house. Get rid of the sin. But even after the sin was gone, we still had a problem with the kitchen. You know what we had to do? We had to tear the kitchen apart and rebuild the kitchen. We had to take those old corrupt floor joists out. Throw away that flooring and that subflooring that had been corrupted by those sinful termites that had been eradicated, but the aftermath of them being there was still there. Eric, what are we doing up at the school? We are inviting renewal through engagement of the truth and rebuilding structures that have been corrupted by sin's influence and offering an education which is consistent with biblical truth and calls kids to build their life around the truth of God. But what we all know to be true, it's not only for students at Calvary, it's for congregants at Calvary Church as well. Father, cleanse our minds, wash our thoughts, help us cast down thoughts that ought not be there, and ensconce your truth so that our minds become a mirror of yours. And we think your thoughts after you. Help us think on those things that are good and honorable and right and pure and lovely and morally excellent. Help our minds be preoccupied with these things and be found looking to Jesus and be found transformed because of such a mindset offering to you a life of worship in the everyday and the mundane. Lord, it's easy to preach, it's harder to live. Give us grace to fulfill what you demand. Amen.